be seated.
Good afternoon. We have our third case for today, our sixth case for the January sitting, 10 AP 1391 CRNM, State v. Jeffrey Sutton. And we have Attorney Colleen Ball representing the State Public Defender's Office of Jeffrey Sutton, and Assistant Attorney General Christine Remington representing the State. Ball.
May it please the Court. My name is Colleen Ball, and my colleague is Caitlin Lamb, and we represent the defendant appellate petitioner, Jeffrey Sutton. The parties to this case agree upon a critical point. Jeffrey Sutton is entitled to some form of relief. He has an arguably meritorious defective jury trial waiver claim, but the dispute is over the process he may use to litigate that claim. Now, Jeffrey Sutton proposes a process that is streamlined. It permits resolution of arguably meritorious issues during the direct appeal process. It protects the defendant's right to counsel during the direct appeal. It promotes finality in litigation. And very importantly, it follows the Court of Appeals' customary practice. The State, on the other hand...
You'd have to explain that better to me. What does that mean? What does it mean, direct appeal?
Okay.
What does he argue? And where does he argue it?
There are two very simple ways that this appeal could have been resolved using the Court of Appeals' customary practices, and they were attempted in this case. So the first one, I have to back up just for a moment for a little background information. At the root of the case lies a pleading error. So... post-conviction counsel did not allege all of the required elements of a defective jury waiver claim.
But so that to say, and I didn't understand it.
Right.
All right.
Right. So she left that out. And when she lost her post-conviction motion on the basis of the failure to include the required allegations, her first step was to move the Court of Appeals to for an extension of time so that she could go back to the trial court.
Move the Court of Appeals for extension of
time. I'm sorry.
For direct appeal.
To extension of time of the 80930 rights, so that back in the trial court, she could file a reconsideration motion that corrected the pleading defect.
Right.
That's what she did. Now, when she filed that motion, the Court of Appeals looked at it and denied the extension. But had it granted that extension, there simply would have been a trial court hearing on whether Jeffrey Sutton's defective jury trial claim was, whether the jury waiver was valid or invalid. That's what would have happened. So the first really easy, simple solution to this case was a deadline extension, followed by either a reconsideration motion or an amended or supplemental post-conviction motion. That would have protected Jeffrey Sutton's right to appeal, his right to counsel, and it would have prevented the huge mess that followed thereafter. The second point in the process where we could have had a sort of a simple and efficient solution to this appeal was after counsel filed a no-merit report. So she doesn't get her extension. She tries all sorts of procedural maneuvers to try and get the case back in the circuit court, fails, and files a no-merit report. Now, we know that during a no-merit proceeding, the Court of Appeals' task is to independently review the record very thoroughly in search of arguably meritorious issues. And this Court's decision in Allen, for example, even makes a special point of saying, hey, Court of Appeals, when you're doing that, you're also looking for unpreserved errors, especially if the reason those errors are not preserved is because post-conviction counsel missed them. And Anders tells us that once the Court of Appeals finds an arguably meritorious issue, it must make sure that the defendant is represented by counsel and allow that issue to be litigated. So the second really easy solution to this case is when it looked at the no merit briefs and the supplement, the record as a whole, the Court of Appeals simply should have rejected the no merit report, remanded the case to the circuit court with an extension of the 80930 deadline.
Could they have done that, though, if in light of their position that because the defect was not part of the underlying proceeding but was developed in the post-conviction process? I mean, that seemed to me their determination.
Well, but, Your Honor, Anders, McCoy, and 80932 require the Court of Appeals to look at the entire record, and this record includes the motion for reconsideration with two supporting affidavits, one from Jeffrey Sutton and one from his counsel, which allege the required elements, the fact that Jeffrey Sutton did not understand the jury unanimity requirement or what a court trial entailed. So this record has all the necessary information to reject
it. You're saying that those cases would have permitted, if not compelled, the Court of Appeals
to
do that. Okay.
Yes, Your Honor.
So you're saying we should do what the Court of Appeals should have done?
Well, you should reverse the Court of Appeals, yes. And what would be a very helpful decision here, Chief, is, you know, there's the Panama case, State X Rel Hep versus Panama, that I'm sure you're all familiar with, where the Court of Appeals pretty much begs this court to help explain, you know, Wisconsin's post-conviction procedure and shed some clarity, light or whatever on it. And what would be really helpful for the decision in this court is if it would say, look, when it's pretty clear that post-conviction counsel has been ineffective so that we can see an arguably meritorious issue, when we see that arguably meritorious issue in the record during a no-merit process, there are a couple different options that are available to you, Court of Appeals, and one of them is the thing that you customarily do, stop, reject the no-merit report, remand the case to the circuit court with an extension of the 80930 deadlines. Another one might be 809.321G, the remand during the middle of a no-merit proceeding. And there are other options, too. I mean, the state is arguing, no, you just shift everything over to collateral litigation, which obviously we oppose, but it would be really helpful to spell out for the Court of Appeals, here's what the options are, and here's what the acceptable ones are, and these are the ones that are not acceptable. So I guess I would just like to point out that the process that Sutton is advocating, this we're in the no-merit process, so this is it. You should have rejected it and remanded it. That process does not require any collateral litigation, and it doesn't require an explicit finding of ineffective assistance of post-conviction counsel. What it requires is litigation at the trial court level on the defective jury waiver claim.
Now, right to the very merits of the ineffective assistance of trial court. Oh, well, it wasn't ineffective assistance.
No, it would be
on error in the trial court colloquy.
A colloquy, yes, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor. I just want to assure the court that this process is indeed routine practice for the Court of Appeals. If you look at the Court of Appeals orders in this case, because there are motion after motion, they're laced with comments like Sutton wants to redo a motion he's already litigated. That's in the appendix at page 16. Or the no-merit process is not the appropriate mechanism to cure defects in post-conviction proceedings. That's in the appendix at page 1. But that's incorrect. The very purpose of the no-merit process is to allow the proceedings to stop and for the defendant to get his claims and his house in order before the case proceeds and is concluded on direct appeal. And it's to allow the defendant to do this while he's represented by counsel. I think as the reply brief pointed out, in 2010, the Court of Appeals rejected something like 80 no-merit reports. Now, some of those cases were cases that went straight up on appeal. There was no post-conviction motion, and the Court of Appeals looked at them and saw an arguably meritorious issue, and maybe they remanded it for a post-conviction motion, or maybe they just ordered briefing, appellate briefing. In other cases, there are situations where counsel had filed a post-conviction motion, then filed a no-merit report, And the Court of Appeals looked at it and said, something's not right. We're going to remand it for a do-over on the post-conviction motion. And I would like to draw this court's attention, again, to a case cited on page 13 of Sutton's brief in chief. It really illustrates this point. The brief refers to it as State v. Chambers, and I would like to inform the court that's a typo. Chambers should actually be Champlain. The case site is correct, but the defendant's name is incorrect. And in that case, a lawyer filed a post-conviction motion alleging ineffective assistance of trial counsel, and the trial court held a Mockner hearing. At that Mockner hearing, the trial lawyer testified. The client did not. The client lost the motion. His appellate lawyer filed a no-merit report. The Court of Appeals looked at the no-merit report and said, something's still not right here on the ineffective assistance of counsel claim. So they rejected the no-merit report, extended the 80930 deadlines, sent the case back to the trial court, where the defendant got to file a second supplemental post-conviction motion. The trial court held a second Mockner hearing on the very same ineffective assistance of trial counsel claim, only this time the attorney changed his testimony and the client actually testified. And my point in highlighting this case is it's a do-over. Talk about a do-over. That was a do-over on a substantive issue. In Mr. Sutton's case, all we're looking at is a chance to correct a pleading defect. And yet, here's the routine that the Court of Appeals followed in the Champlain case, and I suggest that that's their usual customary routine that should be followed here. Another example I would like to point out to the court is that this very case has been up on a no-merit appeal two times. The first time around, the District 1 Court of Appeals reviewed the record and realized that there was a missing transcript. And it's had no problem halting the no-merit process and saying to counsel, there's a transcript missing. Please go order it, review it, and get back to us about whether or not you see a meritorious issue. She did, and she said, I see an arguably meritorious defective jury waiver claim. And so the Court of Appeals rejected the no-merit report, remanded it to the circuit court for the filing of the post-conviction motion that's at issue now.
Ms. Fall, it's my understanding that the state suggests that the remedy here is habeas corpus and that you agree that that is an available remedy. Why not go that route?
Let's qualify my statement here, or clarify it, rather. The state has suggested that this court can make an exception to the custody requirement for a writ of habeas corpus. And I suspect that if this court were willing to follow that lead, that there would be great rejoicing among Wisconsin's criminal defense bar. And I'm not going to rain on that parade, but that is of no service to my client, because we have to sort of consider the kinds of claims that are at issue here. If my client was permitted to go back on an 80930, a post-conviction motion, amended or supplemental, we know that he has all the information necessary to allege a prima facie case of a defective jury waiver. So at that point, the burden of proof is on the state of Wisconsin to overcome the presumption that the waiver wasn't knowing, intelligent, and voluntary. So the burden's on the state there. If we go over to a habeas corpus petition, my client would not have a lawyer, whereas he would have on 80930. He'd be pro se, and he would have to allege and approve all the elements of an
Isn't it discretionary whether or not the public defender's office gives him a lawyer?
That's true, and I can't tell you today whether we would or would not appoint a lawyer for Mr. Sutton, because a lot of it has to do with how much money we have. And
isn't that a lot easier than coming to the Wisconsin Supreme Court on a petition for review?
He was entitled to counsel at this stage of proceedings. So he was entitled to counsel on his direct appeal until the Court of Appeals left him without a lawyer. Then we look at it and think, you know, this is an area of law that needs this court to address. We need some clarity here. So, if he's forced to go into a collateral proceeding, forget about him if you want to for a moment. Think of all the other defendants. You know, it'll always be a question of whether or not they're going to have counsel. And the odds are they're not going to have counsel because we don't have the funds to give everyone a lawyer on a collateral proceeding. So most of those are done pro se. And as I pointed out in Mr. Sutton's case, there can be a fairly significant burden of proof difference. I mean, from Sutton's point of view, would you rather have the state having to overcome a presumption, or do you want to yourself bear the burden of proof of on an ineffective assistance of counsel claim? So
what you say to me makes a lot of sense, and it seems practical, really. What, if any, unintended consequences have you thought of that might happen if we go your way on this, if we give this direction to the Court of Appeals? And I won't ask the same question of the state, but I would ask that the state think about that. I mean, it seems to make sense. You stop what you're doing, go back, have the trial court address it then and there, deal with the issue, either have a trial or don't. I mean, it seems to make all the sense in the world to me. So I'm trying to figure out what the downside is of it, because there seem to be other things that we don't always think of.
Well, I'll answer that question in two ways. I think my opponent would be in a better position to advocate what the downsides of my position are. But secondly, Justice Ziegler, I would like to stress, this is routine, and it's been going on a long time. I mean, I want to give you another example.
Then why didn't they just do it? They just thought you had no arguable merit? I mean, that's what they say. There's no arguable merit to any issue. How can they reach that conclusion when it seems to be something that's so plain?
This is how I think this case got derailed. I said at the beginning, Attorney Silver lost her post-conviction motion and immediately tried to file an extension motion in order to go back and correct it. Her extension motion to the Court of Appeals simply said, look, please extend the deadline so I can go back to the trial court and fix this. Because if you don't, there will be in the future an ineffective assistance of counsel claim against me. And it'd be so much more efficient if you just extend the deadlines and let me do this right now.
What's the authority to do that?
The authority to extend the deadlines? 80980 sub 2. That's the Court of Appeals' authority to extend deadlines. And so I urge the court to take a close look at her motion, which is R34.
So you think they just took a look at that and they thought she wanted a second kick at the cat?
Well, that's what I'm getting to. R35 is her supporting affidavit. The Court of Appeals order is the critical document here. It's R36, and it did. It misinterpreted her motion. It thought she wanted the Court of Appeals to find right then and there that there was ineffective assistance of post-conviction counsel, and worse, it rebuked her and said, you didn't make the two-prong showing under Strickland. And so that's where the case derailed. Thereafter, every motion the poor attorney files is alleging ineffective assistance of counsel against herself. And, you know, she can't do that. But she had just had a Court of Appeals instruction saying to her, look, you didn't even make this showing. So it really, I think that order threw everyone in this case off the scent of the real claim, which was a defective jury waiver. And when I say everyone, I mean, you know, a Court of Appeals judge in District 1, the case gets transferred to 3. It threw me off for a while. It threw the state off. It threw poor Attorney Silver off. But I'm hoping that the light is on now and we can sort of see clearly what the clean and elegant solution to this case is. So
we first have a trial court error, right?
We do.
Then we have a post-conviction motion error by defendant's counsel.
Yes.
And then, in your opinion, we have a court of appeals error for misinterpreting the motion.
Yes.
And I've got marked down somewhere that we got then get a court of appeals error in not carefully examining the no merit report.
The record as a whole.
Yes.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Because had they done that, then theoretically they should have seen that there was a defect in the colloquy and that that had to be go back.
Yes.
Go back. Okay. What other errors do we have? I'm just sort of trying to figure out all the errors, and then I'm going to see who made the most errors. That's how I'm going to rule.
I'm going to see if anyone's left on base after
exactly.
that.
Exactly. I'm joking.
Good.
Because I don't know how it's going to come out, but, you know, I just when I read this, I started making little notes about the accumulation in my opinion from the briefs of the errors. And then the one who holds the bag is the defendant. He caused it all, but that doesn't mean we have to punish him on all these.
Well, he didn't cause it at all, so.
Well, he's in court by something he did or didn't
right.
do.
That's true. Right. That's true.
Okay.
That's true.
So any other errors I should mark down on my list?
Well, I think those are the key errors right there. Those are the ones we need to focus on. And if we get a reversal on the no merit report, it was incorrect, you know, Court of Appeals, you were wrong to find no merit and allow an attorney to withdraw. That's a victory for Mr. Sutton. Of course, you have to have the remand to the circuit court with an extension of the 809-30 deadlines. And there would be appointment of new counsel at that stage.
I have another question for you. Is there a difference between, and I'm looking at your reply brief, is there a difference between your two resolutions, alternative one or alternative two? Do you care which one we do?
I think the preferable one would be to extend the 809-30 deadlines because it gives him, you know, a total do-over with competent counsel, hopefully.
The other one,
I believe, would confine him to just the jury defect waiver issue. I don't know the state's position, but it's possible they may argue something in opposition to the reconsideration thing. I think just the simple way to do it is just order a new post-conviction motion.
Order a new what?
Extend the 809-30 deadline so that a new post-conviction motion could be filed.
Okay.
Now, I guess I just want to stress the advantages of allowing do-overs during the no-merit process. Under Wisconsin law, and specifically 970-406 and this court's decisions in Escalona and Allen, we know that a defendant must assert all known claims in their original, supplemental, or amended 974-02 post-conviction motion, or they have to do it in their direct appeal, whether that is a merits appeal or a no-merit appeal. And the benefit of allowing a defendant to involved in a no-merit proceeding to amend and supplement is clearly it prevents subsequent pro se collateral litigation, which is what that Escalona bar is all about. You know, it prevents further litigation on whether or not post-conviction counsel was ineffective. But in addition, it protects the defendant's right to counsel on a direct appeal, and that's obviously very important. He's entitled to an attorney when he's in 809-30 status. He is not entitled to an attorney when he's doing collateral litigation. Now, the cost of a hard-nosed approach, which is preventing a defendant from correcting an error during the no-merit process, is, of course, additional litigation by pro se litigants. And interestingly, in this case, it is the state who seeks to lower the bar, the Escalona bar, and to open the floodgates to that are now controlling habeas litigation.
You know, it strikes me that part of what is implicit in what you're saying today is this is a particularly appealing fact scenario because it's one thing that's pretty glaringly absent in what was presented before the court. And if you could tether it to that kind of thing, that makes more sense than just like, oh, gosh, I wish I would have made this argument. I'd like another chance so I can make that argument. That's opening it up pretty wide, right?
That's true.
And that's not what – I don't think you're asking for that.
I'm not asking for that.
So how do we write it so that we really tailor it to the kind of scenario that you're talking about where you've got this Well, you can't obvious glaring error that they misinterpreted the motion that was brought, I think.
The court can't write a decision, should not write a decision that tethers it to a pleading error. I would simply rely on Anders and McCoy and 80932 and say, Court of Appeals, if you spot an arguably meritorious issue, whatever it is, preserved or unpreserved, that's when you stop, that's when you remand, that's when you allow a new post-conviction motion. So,
because the Court of Appeals didn't do that here, do you have a constitutional issue?
Possibly, yes. I think we can resolve it without that. I mean, I think really the choice is very simple. Like we were just discussing, when the Court of Appeals spots an unpreserved, arguably meritorious issue, it should stop and the process and allow the defendant to litigate that issue with the assistance of counsel. And on the other hand, you could do as the state suggests and force defendants, those with long sentences, to file collateral litigation, and those with short sentences who've served them, such as my client, essentially you'd be depriving them of a direct appeal altogether. So,
could you help me? I am just a slow learner here. What is the precise provision and language that you're relying on that gives the Court of Appeals the power to extend the time for a motion for reconsideration?
Would it extend the motion for 80930 deadlines is what we're talking about. And 80982 sub 2, enlargement or reduction of time, except as provided in this subsection, the court upon its own motion or upon good cause shown by motion may enlarge or reduce the time prescribed by these rules or court order for doing any act or waive or permit any act to be done after the expiration of the prescribed time.
Are there any other questions? You have 5 minutes in rebuttal, Ms. Ball. Assistant Attorney General Christine Remington, representing the state of Wisconsin. Counsel.
Thanks. May it please the court. I'm Assistant Attorney General Christine Remington, and I represent the state of Wisconsin in this appeal. I agree with some of what Ms. Ball said. I agree that this court could sort of vacate the whole criminal or Court of Appeals proceeding and go back to where they were in the circuit court and have the evidentiary hearing on whether he properly waived his right to a jury trial. I agree that this court could examine the no merit report and the record as a whole and decide as a matter of law that there was a potentially meritorious issue and reject the no merit report and send it back. Much of our brief focuses on what happens to defendants other than Mr. Sutton, where if the Court of Appeals rejects or accepts their no merit and decides that his claim has no merit, how he gets relief when he's not in custody. And that's where the state proposes habeas corpus as a potential solution. Although, as you guys know, habeas corpus isn't ideal because of the custody requirement, and there's many people in my office and elsewhere that think that opening up an exception to the custody requirement of habeas corpus could have unintended consequences. So I guess my position here today is to back away from that a little bit and to say that habeas isn't maybe the best approach to help people similarly situated to Mr. Sutton, but maybe this court could go through a rulemaking process and create a procedure where someone who is no longer in custody but wants to make a claim that their post-conviction or appellate attorney provided ineffective assistance, create a procedure for that person or to encourage the legislature to go through a process and create a procedure to allow someone to challenge the effectiveness of their post-conviction counsel.
Counselor, if we took either result that opposing counsel suggests, either we just grant the motion for the extension of time, or if we reject the no merit report, those processes could be used by many other people, correct? It doesn't have anything to do with whether the person is in custody or not in custody, correct?
Correct. Those procedures don't rely on
that. All right. That's all. Thank you.
Your opposing counsel set a new standard. She's advanced that what she was advocating for was more efficient and elegant. So what do you think is the most efficient and elegant procedure that this court should adopt in this kind of situation?
Under the facts of this case in particular, I think that it would be more efficient to vacate the Court of Appeals proceedings or to just reject the no merit and find this meritorious issue and send it back.
Either one of her alternatives is what you're saying. Either one could do.
Yeah, I think either one would be efficient and help Mr. Sutton in this case. I think the reason why our brief focuses on the relief for somebody who wants to claim ineffective assistance of post-conviction or appellate counsel is that in a lot of situations after the no merit, after the Court of Appeals issues its decision, then that defendant's case would be over. Most likely this court wouldn't accept a review in those sorts of circumstances. And if a person like Mr. Sutton, who's not in custody, what remedy would he have? And the state agrees that there should be some remedy for someone that wants to say, in my direct appeal, my attorney was ineffective, as long as they could meet the requirements.
Well, I have a question for you, Ms. Remington. This is what I hear. I hear that you're joining in with Ms. Ball, and I may be overstating your position, so watch me carefully, that you're joining in with Ms. Ball, recommending the court adopt for Mr. Sutton either alternative one or alternative two. I'm referring to Ms. Ball's reply brief. But I also hear you say, maybe you aren't saying that, but I also hear you say that we ought to do rulemaking so that we sort of clean up this issue, whatever this issue is, however you define this issue. But you can't say to Mr. Sutton, oh, we can't do anything for you because we don't have a rule.
Well, I think Mr. Sutton's in a different position than the defendants that your rule would help, because Mr. Sutton is still on direct appeal because you guys are here
right.
in this case.
Okay.
And so there's a way for you to fix the case under his facts by rejecting the no merit and finding this issue and granting an evidentiary hearing. But as far as another defendant, once they're...
So now I hear you saying that for this limited fact situation, he's not in custody, he's on direct appeal, we've got an error alleged in the trial court, we've got an error by post-conviction counsel, failing to make the assertion in the pleading. We've got a no merit, which should have been spotted, that it is a merit. Under all the circumstances of this case, you're going to give them one or two. But for other cases, this court doesn't say anything. For other kinds of cases that raise similar but not the same fact situations, we should go into rulemaking.
That's my position. Because had this court rejected Mr. Sutton's petition for review and his direct appeal ended, he would have no way of, under the current the law as it stands, of challenging his attorney's ineffectiveness. And as Ms. Ball said she was ineffective in multiple filings in front of the court, but there was no mechanism available. I think the Court of Appeals in its decision urged Mr. Sutton to use Rothering and file a 974-06 motion, and that's probably another error that you didn't list when you were listing errors of things that had happened.
I forgot that one.
That they encouraged him to go under 974-06, but that was not available to him.
Because he wasn't in custody.
Yes,
okay.
Because he got, I think his sentence was one day of time served, so he was not in custody for the entire pendency of his direct.
And the state is not too interested in widening habeas to people who aren't in custody.
Yeah,
afraid of that.
Our brief went through the possible alternatives for people in this situation when they're not in custody and whether they want to challenge ineffective mm-hmm. assistance of post-conviction or appellate counsel, mm-hmm. and sort of by process elimination landed on habeas. And I think by using the process elimination, maybe the reason why we couldn't find a better solution is that there's not one that exists, and maybe that's up to this court to come up with a solution or to encourage the legislature to do so, or to decide. I mean, the state thinks that the person should be able to challenge that, but that's the position we're.
Ms. Remington, is there a reason to just assume that this particular defendant, Mr. Sutton, really didn't understand what it meant to waive a jury, didn't really understand that 12 people had to be unanimous, didn't really understand what was involved with a court trial? Why is the state assuming that that's all correct?
I think based on this record, there is no reason to assume that. There's a document in the record that Mr. Sutton signed that says, I will be giving up my right to have my case decided by 12 people sitting in a jury. I understand that all 12 of those people would have to agree in order to reach a verdict. And he signed that on the day that he waived his right to a jury trial. What the state is, the facts of this case is that under Bangert and Grant, that Mr. Sutton alleged that the court didn't ask him whether he understood that the right that the 12 people had to be unanimous, and that he's asserting in his affidavit and in his response to the no merit report that he didn't understand that then under Bangert the burden would shift to the state to prove that he did knowingly. And under the facts of this case, I think the state would be able to prove that. I mean, the document's pretty clear and pretty short and written in.
Was the plea questionnaire?
It's not a plea questionnaire. It's a two-sentence waiver of trial by jury. It looks like it's a standard form in Milwaukee County.
But there also was a plea questionnaire if he entered a plea, right?
He didn't enter a plea. He had a court trial in this case.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
He just waived the right to the jury trial, and then the court heard the trial. So there's no plea questionnaire, but this waiver form that he filled out. And then the court did go through a short colloquy with him where it asked him if he understood that he had a right to a 12-person jury trial, but it didn't ask him the question of did he understand.
Where does this fit in Bangert and Bentley?
I think, under State versus Grant, that says that when you waiver of a jury trial, you apply the Bangert standards to the pleadings, because the right to be informed that the 12-person jury needs to be unanimous is not a constitutional right. It was a right created by this court in, I believe, State versus Rezio. So this court just in that case said that circuit court should ask the question of whether the person understands that they have a right to a unanimous jury verdict. But because it's not a constitutional right, that's where Bangert came into play. And that is probably an open question, even if we go back and have an evidentiary hearing and Mr. Sutton says, I don't understand, and the court finds he didn't understand, what's the remedy for that? Since it's not a constitutional violation, then as far as I can tell under Wisconsin law, that's also an open question, what the remedy for him is if he didn't understand that. Because on the records and the facts that we have, he understood he had the right to the 12-person jury trial, but that he didn't. He alleges, although that the document that contradicts it, he alleges that he didn't understand that the...
What does he ultimately want? A dismissal.
What does Mr. Sutton ultimately want?
Wants a new trial?
I assume that he wants a new trial, mm-hmm. and this time to have it be a jury trial.
He's apt to get a dismissal, however, because will the state really prosecute someone for this crime again when the sentence was one day and he got time served? I mean, he wants to clear his name and he wants to have the charges dismissed, I assume, is what he's doing, right?
For practical purposes, I think that's right, that
yeah,
the state
right.
would
and
not.
So if he prevails here, he may well prevail.
If he prevails here, he would get the evidentiary hearing,
If the state chooses to go forward with that.
With the evidentiary hearing. But if the state goes forward with the evidentiary hearing and the circuit court finds you understood this, then his conviction would stand. So I think that that hearing would, I would assume, still happen. If he won at that hearing, it's an open question whether he would get a new trial. And if he, but if he did get a new trial, I agree with you. I think that that wouldn't.
Have you had the opportunity to research the interplay between the 97406 statutory expression of habeas corpus and the broader, more traditional habeas corpus? In preparing for this case, I was struck by, of course, as we all noted, the Court of Appeals' assertion that he could pursue the remedy through 97406. And I wondered, to a certain extent, if they had in mind sort of an analysis similar to Cibron in the federal court, where it said that physical custody is not a prerequisite for the pursuit of the habeas claim. And I know the statute imposes it in 97406, and it seems pretty clear that 97406 was meant to supplant habeas corpus, but I wondered about the interplay of that and if that's what they could have had in mind.
I'm not sure if that's what they had in mind.
Asking you that, the interplay between the two.
And I haven't looked that closely at the interplay between the two. I believe in one of the filings that Sutton's former attorney filed, she maybe even brought up the idea of the Rothering 97406 motion claiming ineffective assistance of her, that as an option, and so they may have just seen her suggestion and put it in the footnote. It might be nothing more than that, but I haven't looked at the...
Because it seems under federal jurisprudence, actual physical custody is not a prerequisite for the pursuit of the habeas claim.
Yes, and that's a lot of the discussion in our brief about why habeas would be... Could be a remedy for this, because there are some cases that say that physical custody is not required. Like there's,
but are they on paper? Isn't there some tie?
I think there's some U.S. Supreme Court cases where they're not even on paper, but that they may be facing deportation consequences or some other collateral consequences from their convictions, even, and those have been interpreted as being enough to be custody under the habeas corpus. And
if we were to take the suggestion of Ms. Ball on behalf of Mr. Sutton here, is there any danger that that would in any way weaken the Escalona bar? Has the state thought of that?
If you find that there's merit in the no merit report and tell the Court of Appeals that they search the whole record and...
Sure. Take it, either one of her options, but especially that one.
I don't see any weakening of the Escalona bar under
that. You don't
that.
Think this will be a path for people in the future to try to get around the Escalona bar?
It may be a path, but I think what's important here is to look at that Mr. Sutton isn't, in his no merit, the potentially meritorious issue is not the ineffective assistance of post-conviction counsel. I think that it needs to be clear that in the Court of Appeals, they're not looking at the ineffective assistance. They're looking at errors relating to the underlying conviction. And in this case, you can look to the waiver of the jury trial and whether that was done properly. I think that the fear would be if you allowed the Court of Appeals to, in searching the record for any potentially meritorious issue, if you allowed them to say that ineffective assistance of post-conviction counsel is a potentially meritorious issue, I think then that would weaken the Escalona bar, and I think that that would open the door to a lot of other attacks. But I think as long as the no-merit procedure focuses on errors relating to the underlying conviction or judgment, that then it wouldn't weaken the Escalona bar. I think that the fear is to avoid that claiming ineffective assistance of post-conviction counsel, because that's not really directly relevant to the underlying conviction. That's more of a collateral attack, and that would have to be done at a different point. I think it was discussed a little earlier, but I wanted to say that I think the circuit court does have the inherent authority to allow Mr. Sutton to amend his pleading up front. I think that that would have I think that that would have probably kept us all from getting to this.
Another error.
That's another error. I mean, I don't know if it's an error as much as because I think that my view of whether the circuit court can allow a defendant to amend a pleading is that they can exercise their discretion. I mean, if someone has a pleading error and they don't plead a sufficient reason to get around the Escalona bar, that the circuit court could look at that and say no, we're not.
Hadn't the notice of appeal been filed, and the circuit court took the position that it lost its jurisdiction once that occurred?
I agree with you, yes. Once the notice of appeal was filed, the circuit court lost its jurisdiction. But there was a period in between the point where the circuit court summarily denied the post-conviction motion before the notice of appeal was filed. I think it was almost, I think it was 25 days or something, looking at my notes. But that during that time, if the defendant's attorney had filed a motion, and I believe may have filed a motion for reconsideration properly pleading it, the circuit court could have, in its discretion, allowed that if they had retained jurisdiction. But I think that that might have been one of the other errors that, yes, if she had just proceeded down that reconsideration motion path rather than also filing the notice of appeal. And
I don't think that's how it happened, but it doesn't matter.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Well, I mean, the no merit report was filed December 21, 2009. That was the initial one that I didn't know what the basis was until Ms. Wall said it during her initial presentation. Mm-hmm. So I appreciate that. Sutton then filed the post conviction motion under 80930, and that's where the judge the circuit court denied it because of the omission.
And then
on June 3rd, 2010, that's when the notice of appeal and no merit get filed on the same day.
And I believe, I have written in my notes, and I would have to look back through the record, that on June 4th is what I have written, that Sutton filed a motion for reconsideration in the circuit court, and there's reference in the no merit that the circuit court scheduled an evidentiary hearing.
He did.
On that,
but he stayed it because he lost jurisdiction from the June 3rd filing.
Yes. So they had those sort of happen simultaneously, I guess, maybe.
Sounds like maybe one happened a day after the other.
Well, okay. But yes, had Mr. Sutton proceeded on one path, or it might have avoided a lot of this other. Well, I agree with much of what Ms. Ball said. To summarize, the Court of Appeals didn't follow the no-merit procedure, and this court could take this opportunity to offer some guidance and to explain exactly what they're looking for, whether they're searching the whole record for a potentially meritorious issue rather than just looking at the filings in the post-conviction motion. And
haven't we said that in a lot of other cases?
Oh, I believe that it's been, yeah, that wouldn't be a change from the law. And I just, in this case, the Court of Appeals didn't seem to follow what those other cases say about searching the entire record, because both in the motion, or the order denying the reconsideration and in their original order, they say based on the record, based on the motion as filed in the circuit court, which did not allege that he didn't knowingly know that the jury had to be unanimous, that that's why they were denying it.
We'd have to be careful if we took the no merit route to say that in this particular case, the error that is potentially meritorious occurred during the trial, and not get mixed up into anything that went post-conviction, correct?
Absolutely, yes.
Because otherwise we would be expanding the no merit process.
process.
And, the state is opposed to expanding it. As long as we focus on the error and waiving the right to the jury trial,
right.
Then I think there is a potential merit to that issue, although I think that, as I said before, that the evidentiary hearing, the state would be able to meet its burden.
Right.
But that to stay away from allowing a claim of ineffective assistance of post-conviction counsel in the no merit proceedings. Because
right.
then
correct.
I believe that that would create a path where
right. new
defendants
law,
would
if we,
often
if we go that
try
way.
To claim that their current attorney had provided ineffective assistance and
thank
ask
you.
For remand. I'll also say that under 80932.1G, the procedure to remand in the no merit statute, that doesn't seem to fit directly into cases such as these. I think that it talks about an issue of fact where the defendant and their attorney disagree, and in this case, everyone seems to agree that this guy didn't understand. I think that, and that seems to allow this Court of Appeals to retain jurisdiction while they send it back for fact-finding, and I'm not sure that that was necessary in this case either. I guess
if there are
no other questions, I think that...
Justice Prosser has a question.
Okay.
I'm trying to better understand, if I understand at all, exactly what happened here after the case first left the circuit court. There's a request for an extension of time in the Court of Appeals. Is that right?
When the case first left the circuit court after the post-conviction motion or after the original conviction? Because after the conviction, the defendant's attorney filed a no-merit report. And then that's when the Court of Appeals ordered the transcript and then the waiver form that I referenced earlier and said that the attorney ordered the attorney to file a supplemental report after reviewing those documents. And then the attorney said they thought that reviewing those documents, there was potential merit to that issue. So then it went back to voluntarily dismissed that no merit appeal and went back to the circuit court and filed the post-conviction motion regarding the jury trial waiver, but without the allegation that the defendant failed to understand. And the court summarily denied that because of that omission. And then that's when Sutton's attorney filed a motion for extension of time to file the 809, or for under the 80930.
So it's on a second trip.
It's its second trip in a no merit.
First trip, there was a no merit motion filed?
There was a no merit and report filed, and that's when the Court of Appeals realized these missing documents.
So the court was searching and found something.
Yeah, that's true, and during the first time, it found
so
that
the next time it came up, it wasn't a no merit anymore. Is that right?
The attorney still filed it as a no merit, although I think that no merit might not have been... It's a complicated case because of the facts... But a no merit might not have been the appropriate mechanism the second time because a no merit report is normally filed when the attorney is saying I've searched the record and found no merit to any potential meritorious issue, and this attorney wasn't saying that. She was saying there's no merit as the motion in the court.
Isn't she asking for an extension of time the second?
The second time, she first asked for an extension of time, and then when that was denied, that's when she filed the reconsideration motion and the no-merit notice of appeal. Not in that order, I guess.
Oh, dear. You have an Excedrin?
No. She filed the motion for the extension of time, which the Court of Appeals denied, and... Then, when they denied that, that's when she filed the notice of appeal in order to avoid losing that time running. So she filed the notice of appeal, and then she filed a no merit report in which she repeatedly asked for remand on this issue, saying that this issue needed to be addressed. And that's where she alleges that the circuit court had the scheduled evidentiary hearing, which they had to cancel. And Sutton replied to that no merit report and said that I didn't understand and laid out that he signed that document, but alleges that he didn't understand what he was signing. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Remington. Ms. Ball?
Very briefly, I first just want to explain sort of what was going on with Attorney Silver when she filed the no-merit report, basically arguing there was a meritorious issue. You have to understand the position that she was in. She didn't just file a motion to extend the deadline to get the 809-30 deadline. After she lost that, she was filing motion after motion after motion to get this case back into the circuit court, a motion for remand while the appeal was pending, a motion for voluntary dismissal and remand. I mean, there are a lot of motions, and the Court of Appeals kept denying them, saying, no, we're not going to let you correct the error. Well, she knew she needed this error fixed during the direct appeal, that was what was in her client's best interest. So suddenly she's left with only one alternative, the no merit report, except she also has an ethical duty. She can't file a no merit report arguing that there are no issues of arguable merit when in fact there are. And so you end up with somewhat of a schizophrenic no merit report, but to her credit, here we are, and we now have the state agreeing that in fact the proper procedure was to reject that no merit report and send the case back down to the circuit court for a new post-conviction motion. Justice Crooks, I just wanted to comment on one thing that you said, and you asked counsel, geez, don't we have a lot of cases that say that this is the proper procedure? And my answer to that question is no. What we have are Anders and McCoy and a host of ineffective assistance of or no merit types of cases that say, look, when we find an arguably meritorious issue, then the Court of Appeals is, you know, the case has to go forward, right? But what we don't have is the case that says, what are the procedural options? You know, what is it that the Court of Appeals can and cannot do at that point in time? The Court of Appeals has developed its own practice, and I think it's a good practice. It's what we want, but it would be really helpful to have a case that says, when it's on direct no-merit appeal and you see an unpreserved issue caused by counsel, post-conviction counsel's mistake, here are what your options are. You know, stop the no-merit proceeding. If the issue, you know, if you, you know, remand it back to the circuit court, extend the deadlines, let's allow this case to get all the claims lined up so that you can keep the teeth in the Escalona bar, which is has been so important to this court recently. So because of that, I guess I'd just like to say, don't wait for rulemaking. There's a simple rule that this court can adopt in its decision, and it is this. During a no-merit appeal, when the Court of Appeals spots an arguably meritorious issue, whether post-conviction counsel preserved it or not, it should stop the no-merit proceeding and allow the case to proceed, the defendant to proceed while he's represented by counsel, and this rule should apply whether the defendant has finished serving his sentence or not. And this rule, if this court were to adopt it, would protect Sutton and similarly situated defendants until the day that there may be rulemaking to address the situation.
Is it your position that this can be accomplished by providing clarity to the courts of appeals that they have the jurisdiction to do just that?
It's not the jurisdiction so much as this is the procedure. And I think the problem comes in here is that it was an unpreserved error.
You're right. It was a clumsy use of the word jurisdiction. But there seemed to be some confusion in this instance as to whether they could do it. And so to provide clarity that it can be done and to provide the Court of Appeals with the means to make that judgment as to whether an evidentiary hearing should be ordered, I think that would accomplish or to send it back to the trial court for the exercise of the trial court's sound discretion in that regard. Which are you suggesting?
What I'm suggesting is a rule that says to the Court of Appeals, look, when you spot any arguably meritorious issue, preserved or unpreserved, stop and allow the case to go forward where the defendant is represented by counsel. Now, if it's unpreserved, that means there's going to be a remand to the circuit court for a post-conviction motion that will allow the defendant to preserve his error. If it happens to be a preserved error, then the Court of Appeals would just allow briefing. It is its practice. It's not stated in an opinion, and it's not in 80932, and I think that's why it would be helpful here. And it's particularly helpful when we start seeing cases like Panama and others that express a lot of confusion about what you do when issues pop up in the no merit appeal.
You have two unpreserved errors here. One by the trial counsel who didn't spot the colloquy issue.
Yes.
And then you have the second unpreserved error by the post-conviction counsel who failed to state the second aspect. As I heard the state wants us to make sure that because it's in direct appeal, it's this first error that we're looking at. That is, we're looking at, and that's what the no merit report is on the trial court error.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And doesn't want us to get into the second issue on post-conviction error. Mm-hmm. Do you agree with that?
I do agree with that.
Okay.
You agree with it because if you go that way, the post-conviction issue seems to just be resolved.
Yep.
It's taken care of.
There's no need to address it then. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Ball. Thank you, Ms. Remington. And thank you, Ms. Lamb, for the briefs and the argument today on yet another, is to me a very complicated procedure in criminal appeals, direct and collateral, and 974-06. So thank you very much. And so ends the argument in 2010 AP 1391 CRMM, State of Wisconsin versus Sutton, and the court will meet in closed conference at 3:10. We are